This is General Walker, tape three.
Stress in the jungle or in jungle operations?
Well, the stress in battle, of course, depends on your enemy. I mean, in Burma, we were fighting a first-class enemy, Japanese, who were a far better fighter than the Germans, who were far better fighters than we had to fight in the Falklands. I mean, they didn't surrender. They stood and fought, and you had to kill them. They tied TNT to their stomachs and threw themselves in front of tanks in order to blow up the tanks. And you know, you've heard the story of their airmen who did these suicide attacks on us. So the Jap people in England have forgotten, if they ever knew, that there's no one like the Jap as a fighter. You know, the Russians will surrender, and the Japs will surrender, and the Argentinians will surrender. But those people who we sent into battle in the Falklands were not up against the first-class enemy. If it had been the Japs, we could never have won that war, because they would have stood and fought. And you would have to either kill them or capture them. And that is why we lost Burma. We lost Malaya, because, you know, they were first-class jungle fighters, and we were not. And that is why we were driven out of Burma, because they were first-class jungle fighters, and we were not. And we had to learn the technique. We had to learn their technique. And we had to stand and fight. But we didn't tie TNT to our stomachs and throw ourselves under tanks, which they were prepared to do. I mean, if a Japanese is killed, he goes to heaven. So it's a completely different type of man that you're fighting.
Just to bring you into Malaya, after Burma, presumably Malaya then therefore was always a piece of cake, was it, in a sense? I mean, are you saying that...
Well, except that you were fighting a very cruel enemy who would cut your tongue out and your eyes if you were captured. And so, from that point of view, you know, he was a... Hardly human, and he did it to his own people if they informed. Against the Japanese, and I've seen my soldiers' bodies after they've done bayonet practice on them. My soldiers who've been taken prisoner, and then we, you know, we went forward, and to see a Gurkha who had had bayonet practice done on him was not a pretty sight.
This is
it is. I mean, some people call them bandits. I mean, the hardcore were not bandits, because they had been fighting the Japs. Ching Peng, for example, was, you know, took part in the parade in London and got the MB, I think. So they. I mean, they learnt the hard way behind the Japanese lines in cooperation with us. They were hardcore people. But you can't compare the communist terrorists or the Indonesians or the Argentinians with the Japanese.
When you're dealing with an elusive enemy, then is this very frustrating from the point of view of morale and so on? And if we can talk about morale now as well as the psychology of it,
yeah.
Is it very frustrating and irritating when you can't come to grips with an enemy and you lose patience and you get? I wonder if you can talk about that.
Sometimes. Yes, I mean, of course it is. When you see other battalions notching up their score, and then your own battalion not notching up the score. Same sort of score, and it may be because you weren't as well trained as them, or you hadn't got such a good special branch. But moral force is to physical as 4-1. Moral force is to physical as 4-1. And therefore you have got to make quite certain that the morale of your soldiers does not fall if they are not achieving success. And that is one of the reasons why I went out with my troops as a commanding officer. I mean, some people may have decried me for doing it, and I don't suppose the company commanders particularly liked me being there, but I was determined that my soldiers would be led in the way I wished them to be led. And I was determined that my company commanders would adopt the policy which I had laid down.
That's another thing. Now, how do you actually keep people tight and fit from not only for weeks on end, but perhaps for months on end? I mean, you raise your people to a pitch of efficiency, but how do you keep it there? I mean, it's very, very difficult indeed. It's a battalion commander.
Now, I think if your troops have got confidence in you, and they're being properly fed, they're being properly looked after, they're being treated as human beings, they're being talked to, they're being joked with. When you're on parade, you're on parade. When you're off parade, you're off parade. And you share their food, and you talk about their homes, and so on. Then their morale is good. If you command your soldiers in an aloof way, and you don't, I had to know under General Scott, when I was his adjutant and his colonel, I had to know not only the name of every soldier in the battalion, but his number. And my CO said, "What's the name of that man over there?" And if I didn't know, he would give me what I deserve, a rocket. And so you played games with your men. An officer has to do everything his soldier can do, but do it better and do it for longer. And then he's got their respect, he's got their confidence, and he is their leader and recognized as such. But if he can't do everything his men can do and do it for longer, and at the end of a long day in the jungle, feed them first, go round and inspect their feet, and get the medical orderly to address them, dress their feet and whatever that they may have had in the way of stings and cuts. Then the officer sits down and has his meal. Then the soldier respects him. But if this officer sits down and has his meal first and says, "Oh, carry on, son, Major," that's not the way to command.
Have standards dropped as the army's got more professional? In some respects, the actual quality of soldier has gone, or not, or.
Well, I mean.
Or leadership.
They grow their hair longer. They dress like the civilians dress, because if they don't dress like them, they get booed when they go on the tube or on the bus, and so they have to not look like soldiers. Whereas in the old days, they prided themselves on having short back and sides, and looking like soldiers. The Gurkhas still pride themselves. You see, I mean, you talk to the mayor of Fleet, and he says, you know, it's marvelous to see these Gurkhas in their green blazers and flannel trousers, giving us no trouble in Fleet, and. Adopting themselves, adapting themselves, and behaving like soldiers on off parade. I mean, we do insist on them wearing what we call regimental mufti, and not stopping around in jeans and like their fellow men do.
I think what I'm getting at ultimately is there a place in the modern British Army for the Gurkhas? I think this is all, you saw it starting in, is it 60, or when you first. 61, for the first threat to the Gurkhas.
Yeah.
I mean, is there, if I put the question to you, is is it right that we should have Gurkhas in the British Army? How do you answer that?
I think the Falklands will answer that. When the 7th Gurkhas never fired a shot because the enemy surrendered. They knew that they were up against Gurkhas. And so they'd rather surrender to the Scots Guards than stand in their trenches and wait for the Gurkhas to come. Such is their reputation. And when I was talking to General Prem Chand, who was commanding the United Nations forces in Cyprus, he said, as soon as the Gurkhas came, I had no problem, because the Turks said, my God, these are the people who took our heads at Gallipoli. So our fathers told us. And he said, it's marvellous having them. And there were people in England, generals as well, saying, oh, the political objections to sending Gurkhas to Cyprus, the political objections to sending Gurkhas to Gibraltar, the political objections to sending them to Belize. And I used to always quarrel with these people, and I said, you dream up these bloody political objections because you don't want your regiment to be lost in the British Army or to be made into one of the big regiments. But it's absolute fiddlesticks and nonsense, balls, to say that there are these political objections. Nepal doesn't object to it. If Nepal says no, okay, there are political objections. I mean, my commander-in-chief in Germany said, oh, God, I wish I could have a Gurkha brigade in British Army of the Rhine.
Is it that the Gurkhas have intrinsic qualities that make them ideal soldiers, or is it that they've been trained to be ideal soldiers, in which case presumably you could actually train the British troops to be just as good, couldn't you? I mean, I'm trying to play devil's advocate here.
Yes.
The Minister of Defence could say, well, we'll train British troops who are just as good as the Gurkhas, therefore we won't need the Gurkhas.
Well, I think, you know, can you, in this day and age, when the young behave in a way which we didn't behave in, and acceptable, can you be a soldier from 8 o'clock in the morning to 5 o'clock in the evening and then drop it all? Whereas with the Gurkha, he's a soldier 24 hours a day. And in the case of the battalion, which is in England, so you know families. So he's on duty 24 hours a day. If necessary, he can move at the drop of a hat because there are no wives and no children and no welfare problems involved. Whereas today in the British Army, I mean, the wives are educated, some of them are very well educated, they've got good jobs, and they're not going to take some of the stick which their predecessors took. So I think things are quite different than what they were.
So when it always starts the Brunei Revolt, isn't it? So perhaps you could pick it up at that point. So.
Yes. Well, when the Brunei Revolt broke, I was in Nepal visiting my pensioners, having checked carefully with GHQ that the coast was clear and that nothing untoward was expected. And I was very surprised when they said that the coast was clear, because my intelligence said the exact opposite. And so I had a good wireless set with my ADC, and he was listening to the news one morning and at the same time frying an egg, and heard that the Brunei Revolt had broken out. And the divisional commander, me, was 5 days from the nearest airfield in Nepal. So we did a forced march. We did the 5 days in one day. And a Dakota picked us up, and I got to Singapore, where the commander-in-chief briefed me. And I went up to Surim and got my kit, said goodbye to my wife. The commander-in-chief saw me off, and he said, well, see you in 3 months. I said, 3 years. And he just looked at me as Walker's riding his hobby horse as usual. And off I went to Brunei and arrived there to find that the Sultan was not being properly looked after, in that he was eating up too many troops to look after him. So I said to the High Commissioner, where is the safest place to put him? Oh, he said, in the strong room. I said, with his wife and all his children? They said, oh, it'll accommodate the lot. So into the strong room, that released a lot of soldiers. And it wasn't until some time later, when I had my weekly interview with the Sultan, that the High Commissioner said to me, I think you ought to, he always asks you first, and not the High Commissioner, I think you ought to say that you were very pleased to hear that and congratulate him that his wife is expecting a happy event, which is what I did. And he said, yes, General, and do you know when it happened? The night you put us in the strong room. So I thought that wasn't bad from a highly religious Muslim leader. Anyway, the first thing I did when I arrived in Brunei was to get the Army, Navy, and Air Force together. They were split. The Air Force was in Labuan Island. The Navy were on their ships, and the Army was in Brunei. So I took over the school in Brunei, set up my office in the headmistress's study, and formed joint headquarters. And I said, from now on, this will be run as a joint exercise or operation. Everything will be joint, with the police nearby as well. And this will go right down the line, from me down to the brigades, to the battalions, and everything will be worked jointly with the police, joint with the special branch, joint with the Air Force, joint with the Navy. And I hadn't been there long when Admiral Dreyer came out, and I had the Ark Royal, and he gave me a lecture on how to use helicopters from the ship, from a carrier. I said, I'm very sorry, Admiral. The jungle where the troops are is 100 miles away. And to keep your helicopters on your ship and fly them 100 miles and then to operate with the troops when an emergency is on means that a lot they cannot answer at the drop of a hat. And furthermore, there's another 100 miles dead flying in the evening. So I want all your workshops off the ship. I want all your helicopters off the ship in the jungle. And he looked horrified, but accepted it. And so that was the outset of the Brunei Revolt. Jointmanship, one of my first principles. And we had an awkward time because the governors were still governors and commanders in chief of North Borneo and Sarawak. And at the first meeting, the governors were fairly pompous, and there was also the High Commissioner of Brunei, and he took the chair, and I said, I want to send down a squadron of armored cars to Sarawak. And the governor said, I've just had all my roads mended and all my roads redone and so on. I can't have armored cars. And I said, with great respect, we are fighting, or will be shortly, a war. And these are really mobile infantry with good communications. And they get out of their armored cars and can fight on their feet. They may be the whatever cavalry regiment they are, but they can fight on their feet. And so down went the squadron. And about a month later, the governor said to me, do you know, Walter, the best decision I ever made was to ask you for a squadron of armored cars.
Nevertheless, the workhorse, as it emerges clearly of Borneo, is the helicopter. Now, I want to know, I mean, presumably you'd seen it being used effectively in Malaya, but obviously it was the key, well, really, wasn't it, seems to me. Can you talk about the helicopter in Borneo?
I mean, every battalion in an operation like that should have six helicopters which can lift at least 10 men. And really, nothing happened, really. I had a marvellous commander-in-chief, Admiral Savelle, Admiral of the Fleet now, Savelle Beg, who supported me throughout. But everything got stuck in the Ministry of Defence. You know, we mustn't touch those wonderful war stocks, and British on the Rhine, they, you know, we can't take any helicopters from them. And the Russians weren't going to attack. It wasn't until Lord Louis Mountbatten came out and flew the Holy Air with me over a period of 10 days, and he drafted the signal, and he said, having talked to the Director of Operations, General Walker, I am convinced that he must have the following. And he showed the signal to Admiral Begg, and Admiral Begg said, delete the word Director of Operations and Walker, and just put having talked to the commanders on the ground, because Walker's name is like a red rag to a bull.
I want to go back on this. How early on had you appreciated in the Brunei revolt that this was merely, you know, chapter one?
Straight.
I mean, why? On what basis did you make that assumption that this was part of a wider?
Straight away, because I knew that it was Indonesian inspired.
And okay, so I'm just going to ask you to say.
And even then, Sukarno wasn't using his regular troops. And it wasn't until a good deal later that a much bigger raid took place, and it was his troops. And then, you know, if people remember, the United Nations, and it was decided that there would be a ceasefire, and Sukarno would assume to be a good boy, and all the time he used the ceasefire to build up his forces on the other side of the frontier, and Walker also took the opportunity to build up his forces. And so the whole time the powers that be were underestimating the situation, and it's always the same in war, that the powers that be will not listen to the man on the ground who can smell the battle, who can read the battle, who has his own intelligence, in that I had won by then, or was winning the hearts and minds of the people, and I was sending Tom Thumb, who cleaned the shoes, or the jungle boots, of the commanding officer of that regiment in the morning, and was cleaning the jungle boots of the Indonesian commander of the other side. But he was working for me. He wasn't telling the Indonesians where I was, but he was telling me where the Indonesians were. Because I'd won his hearts and minds. I was feeding his people. I was flying my helicopters when they were going back with a pregnant woman. And that pregnant woman was going into hospital. And the troops on the ground all had their medical orderlies. And as I said before, the SAS, they had a medical orderly. He had a clinic. And all the wives and the men came to the clinic. And retreated. And while they were treated, he was asking them questions and said, you know, do you happen to know, or, you know, in the most indirect way. And it started off by being straightforward anti-CCO, anti-Chinese Communist Organization. Then it became low-intensity warfare. And then Sukarno brought in his regular soldiers, supported by artillery, supported by mortars, supported by machine guns, and as we said before, trained by us. And they were tough fighters, well equipped. And that became high intensity.
That point.
And the powers that be in London were resisted, and resisted because we had told the United Nations that we would not go across the border. And, suddenly, for the world to be told that we were fighting a war on Indonesian territory, would put us in the dock. And first of all, they limited me to 5,000 yards. Well, you can't say to the soldiers, you will measure 5,000 yards. And obviously they went 8,000 yards sometimes, or 9,000 yards. And in the jungle, you can't measure by any distance at all. And they went where they found the Indonesians, who were generally in a village. And we never, ever fired on a single civilian. And we got, our target was the, we went, and so the, I laid down a number of rules which were known as the Golden Rules, which were fairly restrictive, and which meant that the commanding officer himself had to plan the operation in very great detail, and I went down as director of operations with the object of picking as many holes in his plan as I could, because I was told quite clearly that on no account could a helicopter go across the frontier and evacuate any wounded. I was told that on no account was a dead body to be left behind which could be photographed by Sukarno and shown to the world, or a wounded man taken prisoner, or a not wounded man taken prisoner and photographed. And so the battalion concerned had to make for me a mud model of the place that he was going to attack, and exactly how he's going to do it, in precise detail. And I had with me a staff officer taking the notes, and therefore I did not allow it to be launched unless I was quite certain that it would be 100% successful. And if I felt that it was not going to be successful, then I did not allow it. I did not allow Malay troops to do it. And so the chances were that if it was launched, it would be successful, because we had made and taken every precaution.